It's Thursday, August 1st, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. A big story out of the Olympics is that of Italian boxer Angela Carini. She pulled out of her bout 46 seconds in. It was against an Algerian boxer named Amane Khalif. And here, the stadium announcer informs the stunned crowd.
Abandoned. Victorious by abandon. In red from Algeria.
Abandonment. She gave up. Carini claimed that she had never been hit that hard in her life, and indeed the tape shows she walked into a vicious left jab thrown by the taller and apparently stronger Khalif. Khalif, however, did not come into the competition as an unknown. She competed in Tokyo, being defeated in the quarterfinals in the lightweight division. She's now fighting in welterweight. Then last year, Khalif was suspended by the International Boxing Association for an unpublished result, which showed that she had XY chromosomes. So that means she's a man, right? Well, no, it's more complicated. Remember, I said man, not male. There are many conditions of XY chromosomes that we would call a woman, and we certainly have called a woman for hundreds of years. There is androgen insensitivity syndrome, whereas a person could have XY chromosomes, but not necessarily female genitalia. There are internal testes, which is a characteristic of hyperandrogenism, which could confer an advantage to a woman, meaning a girl who was brought up a girl, has no reason to think she's not a girl, and lives life as a woman. But still, there is a testosterone advantage to the development that could show up in the development of strength. And that could very well be Khalif's condition. Research has shown that there is some athletic advantage to the testosterone produced, but it's not the end-all be-all, and different sports bodies have made different decisions about competitors with this condition. We are watching many Olympic sports. There are many beloved female athletes who probably have this condition. It's just that their sport don't test or really care about it, haven't thus far. The sporting federations did decide that Khalif could compete in 2021. That was the 2020 Olympics were held then. It's not cut and dried. It's not just she's a man, full stop. It's not even she certainly has advantages over females. The boxing federations have considered all that. The Olympics have considered all that. She is not breaking the rules. So I do wonder a couple of things. One, I do wonder if we could ever have a useful discussion of this, which leads me to the second thing I wonder, will NBC even engage? To me, it's a fascinating story, a legitimate story. I was watching coverage on NBC today. I didn't see them talking about it. I went to their website. There is not coverage of it under news. Yesterday, I didn't see Mike Tirico bringing into studio a scientist to break it all down, but he should. They should not shy away from their so far spectacularly remunerative broadcast. But I also wonder if Angela Carini, the Italian boxer who gave up, wasn't just psyched out before she even stepped in the ring. It happens. She says to herself, not, ooh, I was punched hard, but I was punched too hard. Without the knowledge of Khalif's status as having been suspended once, might she have just said, okay, gotta avoid that kind of shot next time, which even process the shot as being hit harder than she's ever hit before. I wonder if Khalif's next opponent, Hungarian Luka Hamori, won't rise to the challenge. Having an XY chromosome doesn't ipso facto make you a man. It definitely doesn't make you unbeatable. And rising to the challenge of an opponent with advantages, and the challenge of the world scrutinizing your fundamental gender status, especially if you're from a country where transgenderism is punishable by death, that is all part, in a way, of the Olympic creed, right? Sitius, altius, fortius, faster, higher, stronger. Fortius means stronger, and strength comes from many sources. On the show today, a massive prisoner exchange. But first, Kamala Harris has gotten a bump in the polls nationally. She has pulled even with Donald Trump. And in key states, she's right within striking range. Sugar rush, honeymoon, summer swoon, or no go-to idiom, just Kamala Harris doing well in the polls. We'll talk about it all with pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson up next. Kamala Harris is doing very well in the polls compared to A, how Joe Biden was doing, and B, the expectation of how she would do when people were asked, what do you think of a potential matchup between Harris and Donald Trump? But when I say the polls, I mean national polling, and it's really not the nation that votes. Did you know this? You know about the Electoral College? Well, so do the candidates, so do the pollsters, so do the American people. We're going to get into it all with Kristen Soltis Anderson, who's a conservative pollster, a CNN contributor. Welcome to The Gist.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I see a lot of your bio says a Republican pollster, and I have 2 points on that. You like conservative better than Republican. That seems to make sense. And I probably have interviewed on the show people who, if you're a Republican pollster, they should be identified as a Democrat pollster, but I've just identified them as a pollster. So what's going on with that designation?
I think it's helpful to indicate that I typically work for clients on sort of the center right. But I find that when you say Republican pollster or Democratic pollster, people assume either A, that you're only polling Republicans or only polling Democrats, which is not true. Now, your listeners are, I would assume, much more sophisticated that they get that that's not the case. But that's one.
I don't know if that's true, but it's always good to flatter the listeners.
That is one misconception that I often have to dispel. And the other is when you say with a particular party, the notion is that you are you sort of pushing that party's agenda, which I never want to do as well. So I don't mind if people call me a Republican pollster. But when I get to pick, I say conservative pollster because I think it better expresses that it's more about sort of an idea set that I'm often, those are the sorts of clients I'm often working for, rather than like, oh, I'm only surveying Republicans or something like that.
Okay, let's talk about Kamala Harris. First of all, just give us the updates of what the most reliable polls are telling us. What insights are can we glean from what the public thinks about her candidacy thus far?
So the polling around Kamala Harris suggests she is getting a bump relative to where Joe Biden had been performing. And the way I've described this is out in space, there are black holes that bend light around them. That's how, you know, astronomers, astrophysicists can tell things about our universe as they look at the way light is sort of bent and warped around black holes and other big gravitational forces. Joe Biden's advanced age and seeming decline was this massive gravitational force pulling on our very pretty evenly divided country to make it so that Donald Trump was up by, you know, a sizable number of points in poll after poll after poll after poll, even before the big debate debacle of late June. Now with that gone, it's like you've removed that black hole from the equation, and now you are getting this non-warped picture of a very closely divided country. And so, you know, just this morning, there was some polling released from a Republican polling firm, Public Opinion Strategies. They are one of, you know, another firm that I think does good work. And they did some battleground polling. They found Harris was up by a couple of points over Trump in Pennsylvania. In Wisconsin, they found Trump was ahead in Arizona, and then they found the race basically neck and neck in Nevada and Michigan.
And all of those states, they're different levels. But what is the relative bump that Trump that Harris got compared to what Biden was doing in those states?
In general, I think Biden had been trailing by 4 or 5 points. And now that you're back to close, I mean, it seems like a reversion of about 6 points. And that's what CNN's national polling, I think, showed as well. The New York Times Siena poll. They had shown like a massive Biden deficit. And then suddenly now Harris becomes the candidate and it's very closely divided. So I think this is kind of resetting back to a race where the distorting feature of one of these candidates may not even be able to make it for the next 4 years, and I as a voter just can't get there. With that taken off the table, now we're back to a, are you right? Are you left? Do you like Donald Trump? Do you not like Donald Trump? Like, that's become the axis around which this campaign is being fought again.
Is the relative gain of 6 points, you say, and that's from this one poll, is that showing up consistently throughout the states, or are different states, or any states having wild outliers from that 6-point-ish bump?
So my unsatisfying answer is we don't have enough data yet that's really good and quality and public to make those distinctions. I am a contributing writer at the New York Times, so I have my bias here as well. But I think the work that Nate Cohn and the folks there do in the New York Times Siena poll is unparalleled. And so my view is sort of like, wake me up when their data drops and they tell me what's going on in these states.
Yeah.
But what I would suspect is what you've seen underlying the data so far from those polls is that Harris's coalition looks a lot more like Obama's coalition than Biden's coalition. So Obama's coalition was very, very inclusive of younger voters, really ran up the numbers among voters of color, Latino voters, Black voters, Asian American voters. And then Donald Trump comes on the scene and Democrats run Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden against him. And those candidates, especially Joe Biden, does better among older voters. Suddenly, you know, this Trump-Biden rematch, you saw almost no generation divide on who people would vote for, which was very strange compared to the Obama era. You saw Trump beginning to do better among Black voters, in particular Black men. And people said, oh, you know, we've got this new realignment. I think removing Biden and putting Harris in as the candidate has reset things back to the kind of Obama era factory settings where Democrats are doing better among younger voters. Republicans now see an opportunity with older voters. It's going to look more kind of conventional, if by conventional you mean like 2000s, 2010s.
Yeah. So first of all, just a little, I chafe at the word coalition. It seems those people could be peeled away. So are they really part of a coalition or just someone who told a pollster that they're going to vote for the person now, which gets me to the idea of the honeymoon period or the sugar rush. Now, the thing about the honeymoon period is we all know couples who still seem to be in their honeymoon period, right? They love each other very much and maybe even can't keep their hands off of them. And the sugar rush, I mean, the concept is that there is a crash, but what the crash could come in 110 days or 200 days or 10 days. So I think these concepts are maybe useful, but also somewhat distortive analogies to try to get at the concept of how lasting will this polling surge that you're or rush that you're talking about, how lasting will it be? Are there any ways to figure that out from the polling, from past polling, from any other factors?
I think the thing to watch is to what extent people have strong views about Kamala Harris. Because right now, most people have strong views about Donald Trump. You know how you feel about Donald Trump. And with Biden, to an extent, they were pretty locked in too. But with Harris, a lot of people know her name. But not a lot of people have very well-formed opinions of her. In part, you can blame the Biden administration for not putting her out there, or you can say that was intentional. Now she has the benefit of being a little more of an unknown quantity. But she's somebody with very high name ID, but with a lot of room to still shape what voters think about her. There was a new focus group put out today by the New York Times that my friend and colleague Margie Omero moderated. It was among Democratic voters kind of trying to get their impressions of Kamala Harris. Now, she ran for the Democratic nomination in 2020 and did so unsuccessfully. I believe she didn't even make it to Iowa, right? She was not somebody that Democratic voters loved or were passionate about. And yet in this focus group that Margie does, she asks them things like, if you had to describe Kamala Harris as a car, what would you describe her as?
That's
and it was
great.
All positive, right? Like, she's a Porsche. She's going from zero to president really fast. And it was, and so I don't know if that's sugar rush or if that is, she is just somehow fundamentally different.
Fuel injected.
Yeah. Is she just different?
Yeah.
To these voters? Or is it not to abuse a sort of like a dating analogy, but that Democratic voters had been in this unsatisfying relationship with Joe Biden's candidacy for so long that now that they've like finally ended this long relationship that was going nowhere, that Harris, they're like, look, she's wonderful because she can be president for 4 years. Like,
they've got new relationship energy.
Is that what is going on here? And it could be. So what I would tell you when you're looking at the data is, to what extent are people forming strong opinions about Harris? And are they positive or negative? Because right now, if you say, are you favorable or unfavorable to Kamala Harris? A lot of people are going to say, I'm somewhat favorable. I'm somewhat unfavorable. I'm still learning. As those numbers get stronger and stronger one way or the other, that's what's going to tell you that people are now more set in their ways and less persuadable.
Right. So when you're talking about what how strong people's opinions are, you said she has the opportunity to build on that. But of course, he, Trump, has not just the opportunity, the imperative, and he's definitely this is his absolute instinct to define her negatively. I guess how well they do in each is going to be a major factor in how strong people's opinions are. There's different ways, though, to go negative. Are you, and we saw yesterday at the NABJ, I think, I'll opine, Trump engaged in a really poor way to do that by questioning her blackness and when she identified as black. And it's not just that it might be horribly offensive to people. There seems to be no accuracy. I don't know where he got that from. A lot of times he'll put forward a talking point, and sometimes maybe there'll even be some truth to it, like she failed the bar exam. She did once. I don't know how much that matters, but there's some truth to it. A lot of times it'll just be something that was floating out there. We in the mainstream won't understand it, but it was a common concept, say, in the right-wing sphere. I have no idea what he was doing with that. So my two-part question, sorry, I know a pollster doesn't like to ask that, is how much will it depend on Trump driving up her negatives? And do you have any inkling about what the quote unquote effective ways to do that versus the ineffective ways to do that might be?
So I am stunned at how flat-footed it seems the Trump campaign has been caught at this change, because
I agree.
Yeah, like it felt like the day after that debate, this is where this was all headed, that there had to be a change. There was no way it wasn't going to be Kamala Harris. Like I guess it's very easy to say this in hindsight, but I just don't understand how you have a month to prepare for this change, and yet you kind of wind up being really unprepared. The way a message works is twofold. It is simple, and it taps into something that people already, it either taps into pre-existing beliefs or beliefs that are not hard to plant, right? So think about the 2012 campaign. Mitt Romney was he was a name that a lot of people knew, but he was still being defined. And the Obama campaign very effectively defined him as this guy is a rich guy who is disconnected from what people like you want and need, and he's going to make a government that's not for you, that's for the rich. It was very easy to build that case, and it was clear, it was simple. Like, they were on that message repeatedly. For the Trump campaign, look, they have a lot to work with. There are plenty of things that Harris has said and done in the past that are out of step with where the mainstream median voter is. And so the question is, do they try to make the case that she's too liberal? Do they try to make the case that she's phony? It seems to be that that's the message that they've picked, which I'm not sure is the best one. But they're saying, oh, she flip-flopped. Oh, look, she's phony about X, Y, and Z. That seems to be the direction they're going. I'm not confident that's the best choice. There's the, is she inexperienced? Is she not ready for the job? I think that's harder to prosecute because she has ultimately been the vice president for 4 years. That's harder to prosecute that case. There's lots of different ways you can go about this, and it doesn't seem to me like the Trump campaign has picked yet what their message will be.
John Kennedy did a big segment on the show where labeling her a ding-dong seemed to be one of the one of his avenues of
pursuit. Trying to make the case that she's not that smart, I think, is a bit foolish, to put it like mildly. There are ways that you could say she has not stepped up to the plate and done things on policies that matter to you, the median voter, that will make your lives better, and her administration will not suddenly be somehow different. You know, we've had so much back and forth over the last week and a half or two about, is she the border czar or not? Well, that's technically not a government title. Well, it was a more narrow mandate about the northern, but I have not heard a lot of people arguing she did a great job with the mandate she was given to address the root causes of migration from Central America. And so there are opportunities there to say her record as vice president, her record in the Senate was not sterling, was not in line with where the median voter is. But instead, it seems as though the Trump folks have decided to go for this like character assassination, you know, type. She's phony. She's not smart. I'm just not sure that that seems to me to be the type of thing that's really going to turn a swing voter away from her. And I think it's complicated by the fact that Donald Trump is a Republican's nominee.
Yes.
Donald Trump has changed his position on a million different things before.
Right.
And that kind of gets hand-waved away. And so they seem to have been caught out by this change at the top of the ticket. And I cannot tell you in a single sentence what the Trump campaign's message is to define Harris. And that's a problem. They need to solve that fast.
Last question. There'll be a vice presidential announcement. Historically, there's sometimes a tiny little bump, but sometimes not. There usually is an appreciable bump after the convention. But since Harris already got this sugar rush, honeymoon, whatever we're seeing, do you expect that phenomenon to reassert itself this time?
I don't think that vice presidential candidates change much. Oddly enough, that was the one thing from Trump's interview at NABJ where he was sort of given a question that should have been an opportunity for him to praise his vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance. And he kind of whiffed on that part of it. But he did say what the political science shows, which is that these choices typically, unless you do something like pick a Sarah Palin, where it like really throws out of whack what people think about you and sends a signal about who you are as a candidate that's very different.
Game change. Yeah.
Game change. then it probably won't matter. I do think that if she chooses somebody like Mark Kelly from Arizona or Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania, those are important battleground states. And to the extent they can get you even a half a point, like that's not nothing.
Yeah.
This speaks
I'm sure you did too. Nate Silver did the analysis and he finds a historic 0.4% bump.
Right.
Which would have affected 1,195 of the last 10,000 races or whatever. But yeah, that's probably worth 0.4%.
Well, and since you said this was the last question, I'll end on this, which is a take not just on the vice presidential thing, but kind of on the way I hope your listeners will think about all of the developments and ups and downs that are going to come in the next few months. We have a habit of thinking nothing matters, right? Donald Trump does something insane. He says the stuff he said at NABJ yesterday, what have you. And we go, yeah, well, that's not really going to move numbers. Nothing matters. But at the same time, in a race that is looking to be as close as this race could shape up to be, everything matters. Everything matters. The way a handful of voters who don't like either candidate feel when they wake up in the morning and have their coffee before they vote could change everything, could change the future of this country. So I feel so torn between the idea that like it feels like nothing matters because things that would have been horribly disqualifying to politicians two decades ago now barely register in the numbers. But barely registering is not the same as 0% registering. And even a change of 0.4% could mean a lot in an election that's very closely divided.
And do you think she'll get a convention bump given that she got she already received a bump from this honeymoon period?
Yeah, I think in some ways the sequence of things has gone optimally for Democrats because she's getting this nice honeymoon bump. And then if it were to start fading, as soon as it starts fading, you know, she'll get the VP pick. Maybe that sustains some good coverage for a few days. Then you get the Democratic convention. That sustains some good coverage for a few days. But the half-life on a lot of things is very short as well. Donald Trump was a millimeter away from getting shot in the head, like a couple of, not even 3 weeks ago. And yet that is something that we haven't even talked about on this show. We've been talking about politics for 45 minutes and it hasn't even come up. And it's like the amount of things that happen that in any other election cycle would have been the biggest thing, but now kind of barely register on the Richter scale is wild. So that's also just something to keep in mind. There's going to be a lot of stuff sustaining good coverage for Harris, but stuff also has a very short half-life these days, and it is on to the next. As quickly as something has happened, we're on to the next topic.
Kristen Soltis Anderson is a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times, a contributor to CNN, and a Republican/conservative pollster. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now the spiel. A multi-nation prisoner swap has been announced. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich, former Marine Paul Whelan, they're being released from Russian confinement as part of a deal between Russia and the United States, plus Germany, Poland, Slovenia, and Norway. One prisoner was released from Belarus to Germany.
We have 12 German nationals and Russian political prisoners heading to Germany. Now they are free. And in exchange, we have 8 Russian nationals going back to Russia, among them a cyber criminal held by the United States, a money launderer.
When you hear about a deal this complex, you expect to hear about a second-round draft pick or Russia swearing to include a jailed dissident to be named later. But really, it is a fine day. The complexity of the deal underscores, I think, the depravity of the Russian system. In addition to Gerskovich and Whelan, the U.S. and their allies secured the release of Alsu Karmasheva, who is an editor for Voice of Europe. That's like the Voice of America in Europe. Also, Vladimir Kara-Murza, who's a critic of Putin, who writes for The Washington Post, among other publications. Plus, there were dozens or a dozen allies of Alexei Navalny and similarly situated political prisoners. Now, it is still a fact that there are others still languishing in the Russian penal system. Some perhaps fairly, their sentences all seem too harsh to me, but perhaps they actually did break legitimate laws, drug laws, child custody laws, assault. But I especially think of 33-year-old Ksenia Karolina, who is a Los Angeles-based dancer who donated $50 to Ukraine or a Ukrainian charity, then traveled to Russia and was arrested and is now on trial facing a 20-year sentence. I think also of the quality of the crimes involved and the characters of the people that the United States and Germany released as part of the deal. The United States worked for securing their journalists, their human rights workers, their members of political parties that Russia didn't like. The Russians, on the other hand, held those people captive in order to secure the release of Vadim Krasikov, a Russian hitman who is serving a life sentence for gunning down an opponent of the Kremlin in Berlin. Vladislav Klyushin, who was sentenced to 9 years in a U.S. prison after being convicted of participating in a almost $100 million insider trading scheme where he hacked corporate computer networks. Roman Seleznev, who was convicted in 2016 by a U.S. federal court for orchestrating a cyber attack on thousands of American businesses. Vadim Konashkinok, who's part of a complex transnational criminal scheme, an arms dealer coordinated allegedly by Russian intelligence. I would say the allegedly is confirmed insofar as that Russia badly wanted him back. One of the prisoners who was returned to Germany was a 19-year-old whose offense was possessing 5 cannabis gummy bears. Gummy bears for Cozy Bear, reporters for retrobates. It doesn't seem fair. And it's not fair. It's Russia. Whenever I hear defenses of Putin or the Russian regime, as one sometimes finds in the hard right or far left of the American media sphere, I think about the prisoners, the quality of prisoner, the type of quote unquote or actual underlined 3 times crimes. It reminds me of the Cold War when a certain section of the far left, and it was only ever the far left in those days, would argue essentially the equivalence of the U.S. and the USSR. And then you would hear stories which were true about the repression of free expression in Russia, the cruelty of Russian prisons, the extraordinary efforts put forth to prevent the Russian people from ever leaving. It's not at all true in the United States. It just cut right to the heart of the comparative morality of each system. Sorry to sound like a politician hoping to get your vote, but the goodness of each nation. Today was a good day for Americans who were released because they get to be Americans again. American citizens engaged in actually the bedrock principles of America, like freedom of the press, or in the case of the German prisoners, the Western ideal of political dissent. For the Russians who've returned, they too embody what their system idealizes: killing enemies, destroying rivals, and above all else, usefulness to the Tsar Vladimir Putin. So in the last few minutes of the show, I want to play a clip for you. Very coincidentally, just a couple days ago, I interviewed John J. Sullivan, who is the retired ambassador to Russia during the Trump administration, who was then retained by the Biden administration. Rare among ambassadors for that to happen, but the Biden administration recognized that he was doing a good job. And even though the full interview from me and Sullivan won't air until his book is out, pub date is, I think, August 6th, we'll air the interview soon thereafter, I wanted to play the parts where we happened to talk about his efforts to assist Paul Whelan. Hear now that tape.
Paul was arrested in Moscow at the end of December of 2018. In fact, I remember the day was a weekend in Washington when he was arrested. I was in my office at the State Department, and actually Mike Pompeo was in as well. And I remember sitting in his office and hearing that this guy had been arrested and the Russians were claiming that he was an American spy, which it is just not the case. And so I followed that case as deputy secretary for several years. And then one of my first official acts as ambassador, I went to visit Paul in prison in Moscow before he was convicted, attended his trial. And then after he'd been convicted and sentenced, visited him at the labor camp, IK-17, where he's been incarcerated ever since. The warden told me I was the first ambassador, let alone U.S. ambassador, to visit that labor camp. And it's hard not to really feel for those Americans as I visited them in prisons in Moscow and beyond, in the labor camps in Mordovia, where I was, according to the warden at IK-17, which is a gulag era built in the late 20s by Stalin labor camp, housed German POWs during the Second World War and hasn't been renovated since, with rampant tuberculosis, AIDS, you name it, a very dangerous place to be in so many ways. To go visit an innocent American there, an American who can't speak Russian, for example, like Paul Whelan, it's hard not to see and be really moved by it. So that was, and then having to deal with their families, engage with their families back home, that was as large a part of the job as supporting the detainees in Russia, was doing right by the families here in the United States, because they suffer just as much as their brother or sister or son does in a Russian labor camp.
That was John J. Sullivan, our full conversation about his forthcoming memoir, Midnight in Moscow, a memoir from the front lines of Russia's war against the West, will air on The Gist in the coming days. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Leo Baum interns for us. Michelle Pesca doesn't like when I do that to her name. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. And thanks for listening.